Greetings, programs, and welcome to Parks and Recreation, Episode 2. I am your co-host, Doug.
And I'm your other co-host, Brandon.
We are talking about earthquakes and plate tectonics.
Earthquakes are kind of scary.
Yeah, especially for us here in Southern California.
Yes.
I guess we should start off talking a little bit about what causes them. That's a good place to start.
Well, a lot of things cause them. Sometimes it's the tension in the faults.
Yep.
I think.
And what are faults?
They are the plate, or they are what makes the plate in the continents, I believe.
Yeah, so the Earth is liquid on the inside. It's full of hot magma, and the Earth's crust is sort of like, just like you could think of a crust on top of anything else. It floats around on top of it. So even though the ground that we stand on feels like it's stable and it's not moving, it actually all is moving very, very slowly. But every once in a while, as the plates move past each other, they will stick and they'll build up some tension. And then when that tension finally gives way, that's when an earthquake can happen.
I've heard that Los Angeles and San Francisco might be suburb cities in the next, like, 10 million years. Is that true?
What do you mean by suburb? Are you saying,
Like, from a couple miles away. Like, they'll be...
Oh, people will need to live farther away because happening?
The movement in California will move them together slowly.
Oh, that is... I see what you're talking about now. Yeah, that could happen. There's a big fault in our neck of the woods called the San Andreas Fault, and it runs north-south through the state. It covers a lot of geographic territory, but here in California, you can say it runs from... east of Los Angeles, up through, and it actually runs directly under San Francisco, and it is it a subduction zone, or is it not a subduction zone?
I have no idea.
Well, the point is the plates are moving past each other. There's different kinds of zones. A subduction zone is where one plate is sliding underneath another plate. There's others... spots where the two plates are separating away from each other. That's not what's going on here. And there's a third kind where the two plates, one isn't going under the other, they're just sort of sliding past each other. And I believe that's the one, I forget the word for it off the top of my head, but that's the kind of fault that we have here in California. But yeah, as the plates move and shift around, San Francisco and Los Angeles could be slowly pushed closer and closer to each other, but not for millions of years. So hopefully they're still here a long, long time from now.
Well, that's nice. Very nice.
It would be kind of scary.
It's a weird feeling, but at least we won't be alive to see that.
No, the plates move really slowly. If you were to look at the plates in a time-lapse movie, it would still take them hundreds and hundreds of millions of years to get from where they started to where they are now. When they started, they were all together in what was called a continent called Pangaea.
So Pangaea.
There was no Atlantic Ocean at all.
Continental drift.
Right. That's exactly what's happening. The earthquakes are the byproduct of the continental drift. It's the jitters the Earth goes through as these things slide and move around. It all goes back to... the original heat that existed at the time the Earth was created. The Earth formed out of a cloud of interstellar gas, dust, and rocks. And basically, the Earth was a big shooting gallery for its first couple hundred millions of years. So there was nothing but huge asteroids everywhere pounding the Earth day after day after day. And that made it a pretty hot place, just the energy from all of those impacts. And so, over time, the Earth cooled, and it's still cooling today, but it's only cooled to the point where the crust is solid.
I'm guessing that the reason all these asteroids hit was due to very high magnetic pull?
No, actually, magnetism isn't really what is working there, although the Earth does have a big magnetic field. The asteroids do have a lot of metals in them, but... gravity is going to be the big motivator here. That's going to be the force. So as the Earth got bigger and bigger, it got more gravity. And that meant it was more likely to pull stuff in from around it. So that, and of course, as it pulled more stuff in, it got even bigger. And that meant it pulled more stuff in from around it. And that's how all of the planets grew. But that process like I said before, left it a pretty hot place, and it took a long time for it to cool off.
So the earthquakes cause volcanoes, is what I've heard, and I'm guessing maybe they move the magma chamber around and push it up?
Well, actually, what's happening down below in the Earth's core, so the Earth's core is very, very hot, and that's the hottest part, and it gets slightly cooler as you move out. What happens to hot air or hot fluid of any kind is if you heat it up, it rises, right? So if it's hot at the Earth's core, this hot stuff is going to come up and then it's going to cool down again, and then it's going to start falling back down. And it's going to repeat that over and over. It's going to keep making kind of a circle. That's a process called convection. What that does is there are going to be certain places at the Earth's surface, at the crust, where those convection currents push up and they get a little farther in some places than they do in others. In fact, one of the best examples of this is Hawaii.
Hawaii. And earthquakes and volcanoes formed Hawaii.
Yes. In fact, they're still forming Hawaii. If you were to take a submarine and go southeast of the big island of Hawaii, Hilo, if you went south of there, you would see what's called a seamount. And basically, that just means an underwater volcano. So there's a new Hawaiian island forming as we speak.
How long will it take until we see it? A couple hundred thousand years?
A couple hundred million. Well, maybe not 100 million years, but a few million years for it to get all the way up to the top. And if you look at the other Hawaiian islands, you can actually see each one of those has an extinct volcano. So a volcano that's no longer active or erupting. And what was happening was, think of it like this. Think if you were to take a sheet of paper and take a pencil and poke at it up from underneath. That's like the convection current poking up at the Earth's crust. So you're going to eventually punch through and make a hole. And then if you were to move the piece of paper but keep your pencil moving in the same place, well, then you're now going to start punching a new hole as the piece of paper moves. So as the crust moves over this upward force of magma, you get a new volcano, and the old ones slowly cool off.
I think... I've always wondered, how do scientists, and I don't know what volcano scientists are exactly called.
Volcanologists.
Volcanologists. How do they know that it's a dormant volcano or an extinct volcano?
Well, that's a great question. They're called volcanologists. V-U-L-C-A-N. Kind of like the planet that Spock comes from. Also named after the Roman god of... He basically ran the forge and made all of Zeus's weapons, so he's known for hot stuff, hot metal. Anyway, how do they know if a volcano is really and truly dead? You got to be pretty sure, because in 1980, I believe it was 80 or 81, I think 80, Mount St. Helens blew, and that's a pretty famous volcano. It's in Washington State.
I've seen it.
I've seen it up close, too, and it's a scary place to look at now. At the time, it, of course, was a very pretty mountain, and people went hiking all over it, and there were trees and everything. And it turned out that it was a dormant volcano, and what had happened was it built up a ton of pressure underneath it. There was no opening in the top for lava or gas to come out, so the pressure built and built until the entire top of the mountain exploded off of it, just showering the area with rocks and ash, and it looks like the moon now. It's just gray and really scary looking. But how do you tell if a volcano is really dead or just waiting? There are scientists called seismologists, and they use machines to measure how much the Earth is vibrating and moving. And based on those vibrations, that gives us some information about what's going on underneath. So that's how you can tell. But, you know, it's possible for any old volcano to potentially re-erupt if it's young enough.
Young enough. I've done, like, little studies on volcanoes, and I've always thought that the Pele's hair was very fascinating to look at.
Remind me, which one's Pele's hair? Oh, what is that? Oh, it's a rock.
It is a rock, and I've always thought that how the heck can a rock look like a nest or my haircut?
Okay, so that's a good place to start. First of all, yeah, the Pele's hair, it's a type of rock that forms from molten lava. What happens is lava is, it's mostly molten metal, things like iron and carbon, melted together in the middle of the Earth. But there's also a lot of hot gases that are trapped in there. And so what you're seeing, what looks like a nest, is essentially a rock that is forming out of it's the gas that forms bubbles inside it. Those bubbles help make it look like that when it hardens. So you can see some pretty interesting stuff. Sometimes lava forms tubes, and when the lava's finally exited the tubes, and if they don't harden and clog up, they form these caves, and the caves are partly formed by the gases in the lava help form those large caves.
Did you know that I think it's Mount Vesuvius and located in the ancient ruins of Pompeii?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that that whole area is a supervolcano?
I did not know that. What's the difference between a regular volcano and a supervolcano?
Well, a regular volcano like Mount Vesuvius is a volcano that we can see. A supervolcano is a volcano that is under the ground and it is forming slowly and... There is this this little ancient thing in, I think it's Naples, near, mm-hmm. and they have...
Naples, Italy, not Naples, Florida.
Yes, and they have studies that show that that the city, or the peninsula, I think is what it is moving up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's showing in the heat of the heat of the water. So that they're calling it a supervolcano. And did you know that there's another supervolcano in Yosemite National Park?
Oh, good. So tourists beware. That actually can happen. And what you're talking about there is, you know, when we think of a volcano, you think of a what's called a lava cone, these sort of anthill-shaped structures, and at the top there's a crater, or also known as a caldera, and that's where all the lava and gas comes and smoke comes out of a volcano. Well, like I said, sometimes there's a place where it can punch through and it forms that way. If there isn't, but there's still this upward push from inside the Earth, sort of like you said, it's going to make things get larger and larger. Now, it may be that the pressure is... spread out enough over a large area that maybe it doesn't want to punch all the way through, and so it just ends up kind of elevating the continental plate in that one spot without actually piercing it. But if the pressure does start to build over time in one place, the volcano that forms somewhere like Yosemite or anywhere else that could happen.
By the way, I don't remember if it was Yosemite or Yellowstone. It was the either two. I get those two mixed up very often.
Well, Yellowstone is known for some geologic activity. It's famous for geysers.
Okay, then
Old Faithful?
Which park is that?
That's Yellowstone.
Then Yellowstone is the park with the Super Bowl.
Okay, so Californians, you're safe. Wyoming, not so sure. I think that's where Yellowstone is in Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
Yosemite is still, though, subject to plenty of earthquakes because it's still in California, but maybe not so much volcanic activity. But absolutely, Yellowstone is a place where the internal heat of the Earth is heating up the water that's in the ground, and it heats up, and it comes out of the Earth in these big jets of water called geysers.
Years ago, I don't remember, 5, 10 years ago, I don't exactly know how long, it was either Iceland or Greenland, there was an eruption,
probably
3 years ago. And it was, the tourists, it was so beautiful just to watch a little eruption. I believe it was a quiet eruption, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the gas came, and it took down, it was bad for airplanes, and people in Europe couldn't breathe. It was bad.
Yeah, no, not every... Volcanoes are dangerous for a lot of reasons. Now, the obvious one is, of course, the lava that, burns things. But they also can be much more dangerous in terms of the gas they put out. Now, some of it is hot ash and smoke, and those are bad because they're obviously putting more carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, and we don't need that. And they choke things, and but they also block out the sun, and that can help kill plants because that haze literally prevents the solar energy from getting through. But then there's other kinds of nasty gases that are down below the Earth's surface, and when those leak out, they can be toxic or poisonous. Those can be very dangerous, too. So living near a volcano, you're running some risks.
Pahoho and I think is that... it's either A... Or
it's two letter A's in a row, and if you want, if you want to really win at a couple of good word games, that's a good one to have in your back pocket.
Pahoho and Ah.
Where are they? I can see pictures of them, but what do you know where they are on the earth?
Well, they are like a magma. Both Pahoho and Ah can come from the same
volcano. You're talking about... Oh, they're not a place. They're a kind of lava.
Yes, weird.
Okay, yeah. It depends on what you get. Sometimes lava could be very, very... flows very quickly, and it's hot and red. Other times it just chugs along at, maybe a mile an hour in a big, clumpy, dark mess. Those are Hawaiian words, now that I realize you were talking about. Those are Hawaiian words for lava, and the Hawaiians have a lot of words for lava, not surprisingly, because they live near a volcano. And so you do see a lot of different types of formations.
The geysers,
the water geysers.
The water geysers. We talked about a geyser earlier, mm-hmm. Old Faithful. So a geyser obviously means there might be volcanic activity near due to the heat of mm-hmm. underwater water.
Yep. That's a sign, obviously, there's heat coming from somewhere down there, and there's really only one place where it can come from, which is underneath the Earth's crust. So that tells you that Yellowstone and those geysers are over a location that we talk about. One of these convection currents where it comes up from underneath, it's at the top of that point. The underside of the Earth's crust is above one of these things, and that's what's getting it so hot, and that's why it keeps erupting.
And it erupts, and Mount Old Faithful erupts every 33 to 93 minutes.
That's why it's called Old Faithful. It's actually fairly reliable in terms of how often it explodes. Other geysers could be a little, could be one a day, one a month. You never know. They're all going to be slightly different.
Calderas. I'm looking at a picture here. A caldera is an old volcano, and it...
Yeah, a caldera is the crater that's left over. So, you'll get kind of this big hole in the earth. They kind of look like meteor impact craters, but they're formed in obviously a very different way. But they do have this resemblance. They're kind of ring-shaped. And there are calderas all over the earth. Sometimes you find things in, say, like what's called an atoll. An atoll is a coral reef in the ocean, and they're round. And the reason they're round is just under the water is what used to be a volcano. The volcano finally calmed down and stopped spewing lava, and marine life could come in and live and form a reef, and then you get a round formation. And there's lots of these all over the earth. There's they're telltale signs that either a volcano used to be there or a meteor impact, but those are much more rare.
I have a little question.
Okay.
We live relatively near to Mount Shasta. Is Mount Shasta an active volcano?
I don't know off the top of my head. That's a great question. I don't recall if it's active or not. But it is here in California, and certainly that wouldn't surprise me since there's a lot of geologic activity here. If you know the answer, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to write into us, you can go to write an email to doug@quarksandrec.com. You can also Twitter at us. We are at @quarksandrec. Or you can go to our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/quarksandrec, and leave us feedback there. Before we move on to some of the viewer questions we have, we're going to debut a new segment called The Internet is Dumb. The Internet is Dumb is our new segment where we take science myths, or rather pseudoscience myths, things that people tend to believe, or the kind of stuff your mom forwards around on Facebook and says, here, read this, you should be worried. We wanted to take those things and kind of answer those. So here's a common myth about earthquakes. There's a thing called earthquake weather. People tend to believe that you can predict an earthquake because there are certain types of weather phenomenon that will precede this phenomenon. I see, Brandon, you're shaking your head at me. So why do you think that's not true?
Well, I'm thinking that one of the phenomenons is probably lightning near an earthquake. I just think that's kind of stupid.
Okay, why?
Well, I mean, rain and stuff like that. I think it's kind of... I think the people who thought of that are kind of eh. But and then okay. In a way though, I feel as if lightning could be real to make the weather phenomenon, because energy in the volcano can.
Well, if there's a volcano, volcanoes themselves can generate lightning because, and you can Google up images of volcanic lightning, you'll see some pretty cool stuff. But that's not really earthquake weather. This is the idea that, like, in the months or weeks leading up to a big earthquake, something changes in the weather. That it might be that it gets kind of dry out, or, that's typically one of those things. Those phenomena just don't happen. If you were to plot out all of the earthquakes that have ever happened against the weather that leading up to them, you wouldn't see any particular pattern. And in fact, most of what precipitates an earthquake is what's going on below the Earth's surface. So even if there was a tiny change caused by an impending earthquake, the pressure building up in the plates it would be imperceptible. Most of our weather is driven by the sun. That's what causes our weather to change so much.
Well, and who thought of the weather?
That's an old wives' tale. That's been around time. As long as there have been earthquakes, there's this idea that maybe there's earthquake weather. And because people want to be able to predict them. They're scary, and they seem to come without warning. Some people seem to think that maybe dogs or cats and animals can sense when they're about to happen.
And now, is that possible?
Hard to say. I think the jury on this is a little out. There's definitely a sense that our pets have certain senses that are stronger than ours. They have, for example, they have a really strong sense of smell, but that won't help them here. They might be a little more sensitive to vibrations, and that come just before an earthquake, because an earthquake, the way that it happens is you may not get one big blast at first.
S waves and P waves.
Correct. Exactly right. There might be certain kinds of vibrations that will start just before an earthquake that maybe they can sense because they're more sensitive. So there's some science to say that maybe they can do that. Now, they can't sense it very far out, so even if they could predict an earthquake, you'd get about 2 seconds of warning tops from your dog. And, of course, your dog could be freaking out for lots of reasons.
My dog freaks out for dumb reasons, like a person that walks by or if a leaf moves.
Yeah, that's about all it takes for most dogs. So there's really no truth to earthquake weather. But that's a good way to segue into some of our viewer, or rather listener mail. This is our segment we call Why Do We Have to Read All This Mail? She wrote upon it.
I don't want to read all this mail.
First question is from David M. David M. writes in and asks, is there such a thing as, quote, we are due for an earthquake, end quote? You hear this a lot, people saying, oh, we're due for one. What do you think?
Scientists have been saying that for Los Angeles area for, I don't know, 20, 30 years, whatever it is, and doesn't look like anything's happened. So, I mean, obviously we're going to have a big earthquake, but doesn't mean we're due for one.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it, because the question partly depends on how much time are we talking about. Because, you know, if you over a long enough timeline, we're quote-unquote due for lots of things. I mean, eventually, someday, there'll be a meteor will hit this area, or a tidal wave will happen, or, all kinds of things. So if you wait long enough, sure, it'll happen. But in terms of being due for one, big earthquakes happen for the same reason little earthquakes happen. It's a release of pressure. So but where the pressure builds up below the Earth's crust and exactly the precise location or why is going to be somewhat random. And even if pressure starts to build up, it might be released from a bunch of little earthquakes rather than one huge one. So knowing that we're quote-unquote due doesn't really help us much. It doesn't help us predict anything. So,
I mean, due can mean we can have an earthquake in 40 million years for all we know. I mean,
right. Now, we do know that they happen somewhat, I mean, frequently. For example, we had a huge one here in the Los Angeles area in 1994. There was a big one in San Francisco in 1986, and there was a very big one there in 1906. That was a very famous earthquake.
Sixes are very bad.
Sixes are bad. In fact, that's probably a good chance to talk about what's called the Richter scale. That's the scale that's used to measure how strong an earthquake is. And it's a special kind of scale. It's what's called a logarithmic scale. That's a certain kind of number. So when we talk about a 1 earthquake versus a 2 versus a 3 versus a 4, that's a little bit misleading because it's a curve. So really a 2 is, let's say, 10 times as strong as a 1, and a 3 is 10 times as strong as a 2. So really a better way to think about it might be, instead of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, think of it as 1, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, a million. So it keeps getting bigger and bigger as you go up the scale. So the large ones that we've had recently have been in the ranges of maybe 6 to 7. A few years ago, there was one that was over a 9 in Japan, and that caused a tsunami.
I believe it was 9.2.
9.2, one of the biggest in recorded history. Did a whole bunch of damage to Japan and to their nuclear reactor there, and they're still recovering from that today. How about this next question here? Madison H. writes in and says, can an earthquake cause California to break off from the U.S. if it was a massive one? What do you think?
In a way, no, because of where the plates are located. That's why I think no, because of the location of the plates and the...
Well, yeah. That's a good point. When we say California, one, it wouldn't be the whole state because I think what you're saying is the San Andreas Fault kind of cuts partly through.
So LA and San Francisco.
So yeah, exactly. So we human beings drew the we decided, hey, California is going to be this line is going to be the end of it. It's not based on where the faults are run, but could one single earthquake be enough to actually separate part of California and make it into an island? This is partly the plot of the original Superman, starring Christopher Reeve. Lex Luthor's plan is to create an earthquake that will separate California and thus give him more beachfront property. But do you think it's possible?
Well, you've seen, I think there was a big movie called 10.5 Earthquake.
Was that one like the Sci-Fi Channel? Is that one of those?
I don't remember exactly. I just saw a preview or something like that. And it showed the ground breaking apart. So in a way, maybe there's a mile of the ground breaking apart where it becomes that much of a space. But I don't really think that the earthquake can cause the earthquake to break from the U.S.
Not in one shot, no. Yeah. I think it would... But certainly it's possible for the plates to separate enough over time for part of California to become an island. But that's going to take a long, long time. Not just one big, huge earthquake. Finally, our last question is from Tyler B. Tyler writes in and says, can a big earthquake happen somewhere unexpected? Like, say, somewhere that's really far away from where a fault line is. Like,
New York?
Yeah, New York is obviously pretty far. It's not near a fault line or somewhere in the middle of the country. And the answer is yes, it can happen. It's not likely to happen, but it can happen. Sure. But could a really big one? I don't know if you could get, say, a 9.2 earthquake like Japan had somewhere in the middle of the country, but you could certainly have a smaller one, and in a way, it could be worse. And here's why. In California and Japan, we're used to having earthquakes out here.
So we have buildings that are protective. People like, say, Haiti, when they had the earthquake, they were not prepared.
Right, they're not. And that's the difference. Our houses out here in California and our buildings, most of them were built knowing that this is a place where earthquakes are common. And so they put safeguards into the houses and buildings so they don't all topple and crumble when there's an earthquake. So in a place like here, a 5.0 earthquake is inconvenient and it might knock some stuff off your shelves, but it's probably not going to destroy your house. But if you took a house, say, in Connecticut, where they're not used to that and subjected it to the same kind of earthquake, it could do a lot more damage. So, but hopefully you live somewhere that is, if it's an earthquake area, you've got all the precautions you need. And if you live somewhere on the East Coast, well, then I'm sure you're planning for some other kind of disaster.
Yeah, hurricane, tornado. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. We don't get those out here, so it's a trade-off. Everywhere you live, something's trying to kill you. But it's a different thing. So, anything else we want to cover while we're still on the air? Are we good?
I think we covered pretty much everything.
Everything you now need to know about earthquakes, we have talked about. There are no questions left. But in case we did get something wrong, or you have some questions you want to ask about earthquakes, and we're happy to follow up on them in our next episode. What is our next episode going to be about?
We think our next show will be about time travel.
Unless we've already time traveled and done the show. But I don't think so. So if you have questions about time travel, I think this is going to be a really fun topic. We are going to be taking Albert Einstein, bending him in half, and snapping him a new one. We're going to totally rip the fabric of space. So if you have questions about time travel, if you have some follow-up questions about earthquakes and plate tectonics, send them in. Again, like our Facebook page. Go to our website, quarksandrec.com. Shoot us emails. Tweet at us. Whatever you need to do to get your info to us, and we will answer your time travel questions on our next show. I think that'll do it. Until next time, I'm Doug.
And I'm Brandon, and this is Quarks and Recreation. Let's shake, rally, roll.